One more dead horse would make little difference to the outcome of the battle. Lieutenant Hans Odell had no such problem. When he found his goat Maidi eating the documents in his files, he knew she was doomed to starvation. Bringing out his small library of books, he fed them to Maidi page by page, then handed her to the company butcher and walked away. On the northern perimeter of the Kessel, some lucky German soldiers were actually having a feast. Their bonus was the gift of a grateful Dr. Otmar Kohler, who, on returning as promised from his furlough in Germany, had loaded 30 geese in the back of a Heinkel bomber as a gesture of thanks to those who had given him a brief moment with his family during the holidays. If he had so chosen, the doctor could have stayed at home. It would have been easy for him to make an excuse, to feign illness, until too late to return. But Kohler always knew he would go back. He could not live with himself otherwise. When he stood again in the doorway of the hospital, some of the wounded wept on seeing him, and Kohler immediately plunged back to work, trying to handle a staggering number of patients, many of whom just lay on their cots and died without a struggle. Convinced that he knew the underlying cause of their deaths, Kohler went to an autopsy to prove his case. He joined other doctors around an operating table on which the body of a 30-year-old lieutenant lay stripped. There was no mark on the painfully thin corpse, but it was so frozen that attendants brought in strong lights and portable heaters to thaw it sufficiently for examination. Finally, the pathologist moved the cadaver and with swift strokes made a modified Y incision, cutting from each clavicle inward to the sternum and then straight down the torso to the pubis. With a pair of surgical shears, the pathologist proceeded to open the rib cage. The loud snap of severed bones and cartilage accompanied his dry commentary. Thoracic cavity, complete absence of subcutaneous fat. When he excised the heart and held it up for all to see, a murmur of surprise went around the room. The organ was shrunken to the size of a baby's fist. The autopsy continued, the pathologist's voice droned on. Duodenum, complete absence of subcutaneous fat. Peritoneal cavity, small amount of fluid, complete absence of subcutaneous fat. To Kohler, the verdict already was obvious. He listened intently as the dissector finally straightened up and announced his diagnosis. I cannot find any valid reason why this man is dead. Stunned, Kohler shouted, shouldn't we at least offer an opinion among ourselves? The man's heart is shrunk to that of a child. There's not a bit of fat in him. He has starved to death. His remarks were met by deadly silence, and Kohler realized that no one was about to side with him against 6th Army headquarters, which had banned all mention of starvation as a factor contributing to death. Disgusted with his peers, Kohler stormed from the room. Lieutenant Heinrich Klotz, leader of the oldest company of men in 6th Army, would have seconded Dr. Kohler's cry of outrage. During the past week, he had watched his soldiers disintegrate physically. When a doctor examined the unit, he shook his head, exclaiming, I must say, the condition of your people is even worse than that of the Romanians. The men of Klotz's company died quietly. One night, a 40-year-old man went to sleep and never woke up. Two other soldiers walking back from a trench digging detail just stumbled and fell down. When the lieutenant reported their deaths, a superior demanded they be listed as killed in action. Klotz did as he was told. While increasing number of 6th Army troops toppled into the snow from the effects of malnutrition, the distance between them and their comrades who had tried to rescue them widened perceptibly. Now, more than 80 miles southwest of the Kessel, General Papa Hoth's original relief expedition was slowly being forced backward by Russian divisions pressing in close pursuit. Acting under Manstein's order to protect the city of Rostov as long as possible, Hoth was conducting a masterful delaying action as he feinted, ambushed, and kept the Russian units off balance. Hoth's tactics exasperated not only the Red Army, but also Hitler, who began to complain to Manstein about this strategy of elastic withdrawal. When the Führer finally insisted that Hoth stop and hold every foot of ground, on January 5th, Manstein abruptly offered his resignation in a curt telegram to Rostenburg. Should this headquarters continue to be tied down, I cannot see that any useful purpose will be served by my continuing as commander of Don Army Group. Faced with such an outburst from Manstein, Hitler backed down and allowed General Haupt to retreat as planned. The Russian divisions stalking Haupt were under the control of Andrei Yeremenko, who was still smarting over his recent demotion in favor of Rokossovsky. Intent on restoring his position with Stavka and the Premier, the general was pushing hard to seize Rostov and foil German Army Group A's withdrawal from the Caucasus. To that end, he had already taken Kotynikovo, 52 miles northeast of Rostov, and there his troops had been embraced by thousands of ecstatic Russian civilians who blurted out a torrent of stories about Nazi oppression. 300 boys and girls deported as slave laborers to Germany. 4 people shot for harboring a Russian officer. One man sorrowfully told how they burned down the public library. Another described a lot of rape. The litany of crimes shouted out by the citizens of Kotynikovo infuriated their rescuers. Southwest of Kotynikovo, Sergeant Alexei Petrov spurred his gun crew on toward Rostov. The squat artilleryman had lost count of the times he had crossed and recrossed the twisting loops of the Lower Don, but he ignored his exhaustion as he pursued an enemy who had held his family in bondage for more than a year. In the midst of this offensive, however, Petrov met a new foe. Approaching the outskirts of a steppe village, the inhabitants, men and women, ran out and attacked his unit with pitchforks and hammers. The Red Army troops withdrew from the onslaught and stumbled back with the news that their assailants were native Kazakhs, a minority violently opposed to communist rule from Moscow. The Kazakhs screamed insults and shouted, "We don't want any Russians here," while bewildered Soviet soldiers milled about on the plain. Someone phoned division headquarters for advice. Within minutes, a terse order came back, "Destroy them all." In the general bombardment that followed, Petrov fired high-explosive shells into the village, which blew into thousands of pieces of mud, clay, and timber. Machine guns picked off anyone who tried to escape, and the Kazakhs were killed to the last child. Gazing at the crackling flames, Petrov suddenly wondered why these people had such hatred for the state. What was it about communism that made them turn on their brothers? He was plagued by a terrible guilt for killing his own brethren. Eins, zwei, drei, vier. Eins, zwei, drei, vier. The harsh cadence rang across the steppe as German officers inside the Kessel trained recruits for the infantry. Clerks, cooks, telephone operators, orderlies, men under company punishment for crimes. They all marched up and down the Balkas in close order drill. The man who taught them, Lieutenant Hermann Kastler, did not enjoy his job. Some of the troops had been his friends for years, and he knew he was sending them to a sure death. The soldiers he hurriedly prepared for combat were in a state of shock. Few had ever dreamed they would have to face the Russians across no man's land. Most had enjoyed soft assignments. Almost none of them had come out of their warm bunkers during the winter. As Kastler issued final instructions before sending them off to battle, one soldier broke down completely. Sobbing hysterically, he clutched at the lieutenant and begged to be spared. Kastler talked urgently to him, trying to quiet his fears. The man listened, and then, while the column started to march off, he wiped his tears away and ran to take his place in formation. Kastler watched him out of sight. Private Eckhart Brunert was already at the main line of resistance. Ever since he had detrained from Germany, he had walked back and forth across the steppe, standing guard duty, lining up for inspections, sitting on buses which never broke out of the Kessel. Now he was merely 200 meters away from the burned-out hulk of a Soviet tank, whose driver, charred to a black tailor's dummy, seemed to stare back at him every day. When he first saw the body, Brunert had felt a brief spasm of compassion. The man must have suffered indescribable tortures trying to escape the flames. Still, Brunert reasoned, the same thing had happened countless times to Germans in the war, and that thought helped him forget the gruesome sight in front of his foxhole. His life followed a strict pattern. He stood watch every 4 hours, and at 5 p.m. every day, he crawled back to the company kitchen for rations. Otherwise, he read and reread Soviet propaganda leaflets that showered down from the sky. Brunert never once thought of defecting, but the pictures on the literature haunted him. A beautiful Christmas tree, beneath which a woman buried her face in a handkerchief. Beside her, a little child sobbed her grief as they both stared at their present, the body of a soldier father. In another leaflet, a woman sang carols with her children, while the figure of the dead father hovered over them like a ghost. For over a week, Brunert and his friend Gunter Gehlert had shared a bunker and adjusted to the presence of the enemy nearby. On January 7th, just as Gunter came to relieve Brunert at the machine gun, a shell burst only yards away. Brunert screamed and fell face down into the trench. He stared dumbly at one of his fingers, split open like a blossoming rosebud. His legs were hit too, and he lay in a spreading pool of blood, but remained conscious while Gunter brought a medic. In shock, Brunert watched wordlessly as they frantically fashioned a dressing. When darkness came, Gunter put Brunert on a sled, pressed money into his hand, and asked him to give it to his own parents when he got home. The sled rocked gently through the snow, and except for his freezing feet, Brunert enjoyed the ride to Gumrock Airfield Hospital. In an operating room suffused with bright lights, he relaxed as his clothing, that filth-caked armor, was taken off. After receiving a local anesthetic, he began to dream of good food and sleep without worrying about Russians creeping up on him during the night. That thought brought back the image of poor Gunter alone at the bunker, watching now for the enemy until his eyes watered and he saw mirages on the snow. Brunert suddenly felt very sorry for his comrade. Still on the operating table, he turned his head. Only a few feet away on another table, he saw the convoluted windings of a man's brain. Fascinated, he carefully examined the various folds, some pink, others grayish-blue, while doctors probed his own body for pieces of metal. Shortly afterward, Eckhart Brunert left the Kessel on a plane bound for home. Every 7 seconds a German dies in Russia. Stalingrad is a mass grave. Every 7 seconds a German dies. The loudspeaker's words assaulted Gunter Gehlert, alone now in his bunker without Brunert. They assailed Gottlieb Slota and Hubert Werkner as they crouched in their icy holes on the step. The message twanged taut the nerves of 200,000 men trapped on the step. Hour by hour, the Politruk bombarded the Germans with announcements, threats, inducements, and prophecies. In some sectors, Russian speakers even called out the names of company and battalion commanders. Captain Gerhard Münch learned this when a commissar engaged him in a personal war. Near the Red October plant, the loudspeakers blared over and over. German soldiers, drop your weapons. It makes no sense to continue. Your Captain Münch will also realize one day what is going on. What this super fascist tells you isn't right anyway. He will recognize it. One day we'll seize him. Every time the enemy mentioned his name, Münch immediately went out and spent time with his troops. Joking about the personal comments, he watched closely for any adverse reactions from the men. But though the tactic was meant to be unnerving, they never seemed intimidated by the Russian ploy. Less than 2 miles southwest of Münch's outpost in the Red October plant, Ignacy Changar gulped down a full ration of vodka and wondered where he could find another. The commando captain had been relying more and more on liquor to forget the daily nightmare in which he lived. His awful memories of the past had not faded, and with dynamite, rifle, and knife, he had blown up, shot, or stabbed more than 200 of the enemy. Still, he was not satisfied. As a result, his one-man war had taken its toll on him. His face was drawn, the eyes haunted, his hands trembled. His only relief from inner tension was alcohol, and after finishing his vodka ration on the night of January 7th, he led his men up the eastern slope of Mamaev Hill, carefully threading a path through Russian trenches and minefields to the final rolls of barbed wire. Crawling into no man's land, Changar tried to gauge whether the Germans sensed his approach, but the crown of Mamaev Hill remained tranquil. Reaching an open stretch where shell bursts had blown away the snow, he stood up and waited for his unit to gather around him. Several brilliant white flares quickly popped overhead. As he screamed, "Drop!" a German shell exploded a few feet away. Changar felt a terrible pain in the right side of his head, then crumpled to the ground. His men carried him back down the slope to an aid station, where doctors worked carefully to extract the metal fragment lodged against the brain. Evacuated quickly for further surgery, the still unconscious Changar was not expected to live. West of Mamive Hill at Gumrock Airfield, Paulus learned that three Red Army representatives planned to enter German lines with an ultimatum for 6th Army. The Russians proposed a rendezvous at 10 o'clock a.m. Moscow time on January 8th. Though Paulus ignored the request, at the appointed hour, the Russian parliamentarians walked under a white flag into German lines and delivered Marshal Rokossovsky's offer to an astonished but polite Captain Wielig. Rokossovsky offered guarantees of safety to all who ceased to resist, plus their return at the end of the war to Germany. He also assured Paulus that all personnel might retain their belongings and valuables, and in the case of high-ranking officers, their swords. The general went on to offer a most tempting argument to soldiers about to starve to death. All officers and men who surrender will immediately receive normal rations. The wounded, sick, or frostbitten will be given medical treatment. The Red Army ultimatum demanded an affirmative answer within 24 hours, or else the Germans would suffer total destruction. Friedrich von Paulus submitted the proposal to Hitler and asked for freedom of action. Rokossovsky's offer of good treatment and guarantees of safety had been voiced earlier in January by the Soviet government. In a document extraordinary for its seeming compassion during a brutal war, guidelines were laid down for the proper care of enemy captives. Treatment of POW in the Soviet Union. Order of the People's Commissariat for the Defense of the USSR. January 2, 1943. Number 001. Moscow. The manner of return conveyance and security of POW on the front and on the way to the collection camp shows a number of serious shortcomings. The POW remained too long inside the units of the Red Army. From the time of capture to the loading, the prisoners have to cover 200 to 300 kilometers on foot. Often they receive no food. Therefore, they arrive quite exhausted and sick. In order to energetically discontinue such shortcomings while taking care of POW and to make them available as workforces, the following order is issued to the commanders at the front. According to POW regulations, give timely medical attention to wounded or sick POW. Categorically discontinue sending on a march wounded, sick, exhausted, or frozen prisoners. Such prisoners are to be attended to in a field hospital and forwarded when transportation is available. Also, sick prisoners are to be fed according to regulations for these. Limit the daily marching time to 25 to 30 kilometers. Install stopping places for overnight stays. Give out warm food and water to the POW and have ready a heating facility. Leave the POW their clothes, shoes, underwear, bedding, and eating utensils. If a prisoner lacks any of these, it is a duty to replace the missing objects from loot or from effects of killed or dead enemy soldiers or officers. To the Chief of Sanitary Inspection of the Red Army. At checkpoints, have a control station for marching POW and give medical attention to the sick. Such POW who cannot continue the march due to illness are to be taken out of the column and sent to a field hospital close by. Forbid that POW be forwarded in cars not suitable for human transport. Sent on to Russian commanders by telegram, the document was ignored. The reasons were twofold. Hobbled by acute shortages of rail cars, medical supplies, and food, Russian officials could not cope with the enormous influx of Axis prisoners during December and January. Furthermore, the prison personnel allowed their hatred for the invaders to influence their actions. Thus, as the POWs walked and rode to internment, many Red Army officers responsible for their well-being tacitly condoned their deaths. Vadi! Vadi! The plaintive cry for water irritated Felice Bracci as some of the 35 men riding in his freight car shouted their desperate plea. Bracci had no idea of their destination, and after listening to this pitiful lament for 3 days, he was beginning to lose his temper. Conditions were frightful enough for everyone without the constant whining from the weak. Bracci and his fellow officers were barely alive. 24 slept in shifts on the ice-covered floor, where they curled up in embraces to draw heat from each other. To pass the time, some men whispered stories of previous days and future dreams. Martini, Branco, and Giordano agreed to set up a restaurant in Rome with their savings. Franco Fusco wanted to go into business. Fascinati talked about continuing his career as a public prosecutor. One officer refused to talk of what might be. Instead, he announced that the trip was merely an exquisite torture conceived by the Russians, who would keep the train going endlessly until all its passengers died. It seemed that way. Just once a day, guards pulled the door open to give them a hunk of black bread and a bucket of water. While the thirstiest howled for more than their share, Bracci and his friends carefully watched a soldier whittle the frozen bread into equal portions. The men never took their eyes off the knife as it shaved and jabbed the rock-like meal. Carefully handed out to groups of five, the bread was consumed immediately, and then, in the dim light that seeped through cracks, the Italians rocked along in contemplative silence. As the miles and days passed, each man attended to his bodily needs in a corner, and a cone-shaped mound of excrement rose slowly, a daily calendar recording the length of the trip. The excrement was always gray, the color of the bread, their only sustenance. Bracci slept as much as he could, but when he was awake, he thought often about his captors, and he was torn by his feelings toward the Russian guards. In their strange dress, they looked like big, wicked apes. Boisterous, crude, they showed no trace of sensitivity. Yet, Bracci knew that out on the lonely steppe of southern Russia, their women and children suffered too. Like him, they loved and laughed, cried and bled. But the men who guarded the trail from Kalmykov and rode the train to prison camp as jailers were not the same, could not be related to those Russians who generously gave him food during the march. To these guards, the Italians were mere objects, not men, not slaves. They were nothing. The prisoners' train moved due north, toward Moscow and beyond. Behind it, on the road Bracci had marched along earlier, lay thousands of frozen corpses. Some had bullet holes in the torso. Most had gunshot wounds in the back of the neck. Baggage peculiar to the Italian army lay on the crusted snow trail. Crucifixes, mass cards, pictures of Jesus Christ and the saints had fallen near the dead. One victim sat placidly in a drift, eyes wide open, a smile creasing his face. He held a black rosary in his hands. The soldier had begun the second decade of the beads when a Russian guard shot him. Cristoforo Capone came along this same trail several days behind Bracci. The doctor saw the ravens Bracci had noticed circling, and he heard the same shouts, "Devi Beester! Devi Beester!" as Russian guards robbed the prisoners of their warm clothing and beat them when they protested. Capone, too, watched the weak fall down and winced at the sharp cracks of rifle fire as they died. Like Bracci, he huddled for many nights in below-zero weather with soldiers who screamed from the pain of frostbite or wailed to God about their cruel fate. The doctor pitied these men in their misery, but he had decided to live. Some unknown inner strength brought him to a railroad station and a section of floor in a freight car, where he now sprawled to rest. While an Arctic wind whistled outside and the men clutched to each other to transmit body heat, the train sped north. Capone began to lick the icicled walls to quench his raging thirst. Men died beside him each night, and in the morning, Russian guards opened the doors and screamed, "Skolko kaput!" How many dead? That was all they cared about, the number of corpses they had to pull out and discard in the snow. On the evening of January 8th, Field Marshal Erich von Manstein entertained guests at Novocherkassk. Among them were General Hans Huber, Der Mensch, who had just returned from East Prussia. On the way back, he traveled with Colonel Gunther von Below, who had been invalided out of Stalingrad in September with jaundice, and was returning to duty at a time when most German soldiers were praying to leave the pocket. During their flight, Below had learned from Huber that the Führer was planning another attempt to extricate the Sixth Army. Three panzer divisions were supposedly coming from France and would be ready to attack by the middle of February. It was apparent to Bülow that the aggressive Huber had succumbed to Hitler's mesmerizing personality and believed implicitly in this new rescue expedition. At dinner that night, Huber continued to talk about the promised panzers, but each time he tried to solicit Erich von Manstein's opinions, the field marshal changed the subject. Throughout the meal, in fact, Manstein avoided any comment about the army inside the Kessel. Later, over drinks with staff officers of Army Group Don, Bülow found one reason for Manstein's negative responses when his companions told him that less than 100 tons a day had been airlifted to Stalingrad. Without making any definite admissions about the Kessel being a hopeless trap, they convinced Bülow that he was a condemned man having a last meal before going to his death. The chastened colonel drank until a late hour. The next day, January 9th, he and Huber touched down at Pitomnik and went on to the crowded interior of the headquarters bunker at Gumrock, where Paulus and Schmidt awaited them. Extremely agitated, Paulus quickly told his visitors it was impossible for 6th Army to hold out much longer. When Huber broke in to mention the tanks coming from France, Paulus merely shrugged in resignation. Still, as Huber kept insisting on the need to hold out until the panzer force arrived at the perimeter, Paulus began to show a spark of interest in the idea. A desperate man, stripped of options by the higher authority he would never disobey, Paulus had to force himself to believe in a miracle. Only hours earlier, Hitler had again denied him the requested freedom of action about the Russian ultimatum of surrender. The Führer was insisting on a fight to the death because every day the army holds out helps the entire front. That message had settled Paulus's mind on a basic issue. Tempted to give up the struggle, he dismissed that thought when higher authority declared 6th Army's agony to be a vital necessity. Thus, he now listened to Huber's ramblings about panzers coming from France and, at the same time, issued a stern warning to his troops about the Soviet peace offer. Any proposals of negotiations are to be rejected, not to be answered, and parliamentaries are to be repulsed by force of weapons. As the ultimatum's time limit expired, an eerie quiet descended on the steppe. In their holes and trenches, German soldiers waited fearfully for Russian reaction to Paulus's order for all-out resistance. Chapter 27. At dawn on January 10th, the 48th day of the Kessel, a red sun poked over the horizon and shone dully on the white steppe. On both sides of the front lines, soldiers moved about in cramped foxholes, flexing their arms and legs to drive away the chill of the sub-zero temperature. Around them, the sounds of battle were muted. Only an occasional rifle shot echoed across no man's land. By 8 a.m., German troops standing in line for breakfast were commenting on the fact that the Russians had been unusually quiet for more than 24 hours. 2 minutes later, as the Germans munched chunks of black bread and drank watery coffee, 7,000 Russian cannons roared in unison, and the 6th Army fortifications in the Karpovka Valley disappeared under a rainbow of fire. Along with the artillery barrage came clouds of Soviet planes, racing at low altitudes across the German lines to sow panic. When the first monstrous thunderclap of the cannonade smashed against his reinforced shelter, Sergeant Albert Pfluger fell off his cot. Though the main bombardment was nearly 5 miles to the west, wave upon wave of concussive shock showered dirt on him and shook the ground as if it were a storm-ridden sea. Dragging himself from the floor, Pfluger ran out to his headquarters command post, where the phone was ringing incessantly with reports of entire units wiped out and others reeling back from the shattered front. Mobs of frenzied soldiers were already inundating the rear, and Pfluger watched them stagger by, shell-shocked, hysterical, trickling blood from the mouth, nose, and ears. They were the survivors of General Voronov's God of War, the heavy artillery. Pioneer Colonel Herbert Zella was on his way to the nose of the pocket in the Karpovka Valley when the Soviet offensive broke over him. Switching direction, he headed instead for the headquarters of the 76th Division, which was holding a precarious position at the western side of the perimeter. There, Zella met the monocled, extraordinarily calm General Karl Rodenburg, who told him the Russians had already broken through the center of his line. As they spoke, enemy shells banged into the ravine, and white and mud-colored clouds of snow and dust rose into the air. Zella left quickly. His car passed a wretched mob of wounded, pleading with drivers to take them along, and Zella picked up nearly a dozen of them. They tumbled inside the car, clung to the running boards, or draped themselves over the hood. The strange ambulance drove on to Gumrak, where the wounded helped each other into the hospital. Watching them go, Zella wondered what effect such a grisly sight would have on General Kurt Zeitzler back in East Prussia. If he could see these wretches inside the Kessel, would Zeitzler continue to parrot Hitler's orders to fight to the last bullet? At Pitomnik, Russian shells fell on the runways and scattered personnel unloading supplies from planes. Quartermaster Karl Binder was leading a column of trucks into a nearby ration depot when explosions bracketed his vehicle and blew up ammunition dumps in the fields. Hurrying the loading of gasoline, clothing, and cases of food, Binder hollered for the trucks to scatter. Just as he waved them off, a shell burst tossed him into a snowdrift. Unconscious, he lay there for hours until another truck driver pulled him out and sped on to Gumrak. When he revived, Binder discovered that by some miracle he had not been wounded and that his trucks had brought back enough rations to feed the 305th Division for 18 days, enough for nearly 3 weeks if the front lines held. But the Soviet bombardment went on and on, and after 2 hours it had burst the German perimeter like an eggshell. Soviet T-34 tanks quickly roared through the gaps. Mounted infantry followed. In the north, they punched a hole between the 113th Division and the 76th. To the west, the Austrian 44th Division vanished under a torrent of fire and steel. So did the 376th and 384th German Divisions. That part of the front caved in, and the village of Dmitrievka fell quickly to Russian armor. In the south, Albert Pfluger's 297th Division had broken apart in the area between Zibenko and Pishanka, and the Russians smashed through with impunity. Only in the southwest corner, at the Marinovka Nose salient, did German resistance contain the enemy for any length of time. There, as General Schmidt had predicted earlier to Colonel Zella, the main Russian drive centered on the valley of the Karpovka River, where 6th Army bunkers had been built into the sides of the gorge. Schmidt assumed the enemy wanted to drive the Germans from these entrenchments onto the open steppe and thus force a Napoleonic retreat eastward to Stalingrad. His analysis was almost perfect. His only error was in thinking the attack would come 10 days later. In that exposed salient, the 3rd and 29th Motorized Divisions stood side by side and tried to cling to the nose. But within a few hours, the 3rd Motorized had its flanks beaten in and was forced to pull back hastily to reorganize beyond the Rasoshka River. Still, the 29th Division held on, and the Russians attacked it over the crest of Cossack Hill. Hundreds of tanks, crowded close together, led the parade, and infantrymen clung to the turrets from which huge red flags flew briskly. Behind the T-34s came long columns of foot soldiers, wading through hip-deep snow. The Germans stared in awe at this massive display of might, and then, with the pressure proving irresistible, gave ground. By the end of the day, the 6th Army was on the run toward the ruins of Stalingrad. On January 11th, the situation in the Kessel deteriorated further. General Karl Rodenburg still wore the monocle in his right eye, but he had lost much of his quiet confidence. The day before, he possessed 50 heavy-caliber weapons in his artillery regiment. Now one of his officers rushed up to him and gasped, "General, here is the last gun." 30 soldiers had dragged it for 7 miles to the new line of resistance. As he clasped the officer's hand and thanked him warmly for his stupendous achievement, Karl Rodenburg knew that the battle inside the Kessel was futile. Then the general went out to find the rest of his 76th Division. Once it had been 10,000 strong, now it was just the size of a battalion, 600 men. 6th Army Radio, 9:40 a.m. Enemy broke through on a wide portion of the front line. Isolated strongholds are still intact. We are trying to rally and train last available parts of supply and construction units to set up a blocking line. It was a hopeless delaying of the inevitable. Again at 7 p.m., 6th Army Radio reported to Manstein. Deep penetration east of Zibenko, more than 6 kilometers wide. Enemy had very heavy losses. Our own losses were considerable. Resistance of the troops diminishing quickly because of insufficient ammunition, extreme frost, and lack of coverage against heaviest enemy fire. Captain Vindrik Bear returned from a trip to the front lines and, in a hurried letter, described his impressions to Klaus von Below. Bear told his friend what 6th Army headquarters had not mentioned in any messages to the outside world. German soldiers had begun to desert in large numbers. Many officers in the field had lost the will to lead. Blankets over their heads, the men slept at sentry posts. Without tanks behind them as support, terrified Germans now ran in the face of enemy assaults. Bear said he thought the general feeling in the pocket had become one of simple self-preservation. He went on to berate leaders who directed the airlift. Bitterly, he suggested that Below put some Jews or some black market operators in charge and let them run it at a profit. He closed with an appraisal of his superiors. Paulus, he said, means the heart of 6th Army. The general had the backbone of a chief. On the other hand, Schmidt, whom both Bear and Below had known for years through family connections, posed a special problem. Though Bear liked him, he understood why the general irritated so many high-ranking officers. Imperious, acerbic, Schmidt seldom displayed the inner qualities, the good side that he possessed. Bear found that a pity, since Schmidt had to work with generals now facing a situation without parallel in German military history. In a rambling schoolhouse south of the Kessel, 2nd Guards Army Commander Rodion Yakovlevich Malinovsky took time out to entertain a group of Allied newsmen. Among them were Alexander Wirth, United Press correspondent Eddie Gilmore, and Ralph Parker from the New York Times. Tall, with long dark hair brushed back, the ruddy-faced Malinovsky quickly admitted to his guests that Manstein's December offensive toward Stalingrad had caught the Russians napping, but then he hailed the gains of the Red Army counteroffensive and its effects on the enemy. For the first time, the Germans are showing signs of bewilderment. Trying to fill in gaps, they are throwing their troops about from one place to another. The German officers we have captured are extremely disappointed in their high command, and in the Führer himself. When the reporters asked him about the drive to crush Paulus in the Kessel, Malinovsky was bluntly confident. Stalingrad is an armed prisoners' camp, and its position is hopeless. 6th Army Radio, January 12. Continuous bombardments since 7 a.m. Cannot reply. Since 8 a.m., heavy enemy attacks along all front lines with numerous tanks. Army has ordered as a last means of resistance that every soldier has to fight to the last bullet at the place he is holding right now. At Pitomnik, a single Russian T-34 tank broke through the thin perimeter defense and clanked onto the crowded runway. Its appearance induced panic among the Germans who stampeded away from the planes, the hospitals, the wounded, and ran east on the road to Gumrak and Stalingrad. The tank leisurely cruised the strip, firing at a wide choice of targets, and the heart of the fortress skipped several beats. Hearing the news of the tank's appearance, General Arthur Schmidt jumped to the phone and screamed his outrage at half a dozen officers responsible for protecting the field. Schmidt's anger galvanized the chagrined commanders into restoring Pitomnik to service after a short delay. But in the confusion, in one of those miraculous incidents of war, the Soviet T-34 simply disappeared in the haze and escaped. Later that day, Paulus dispatched one of his most trusted generals for help. Wolfgang Pickert, leader of the 9th Flak Division, flew through a raging snowstorm to Novocherkassk. During the flight, he scribbled notes of his arguments on the margin of a newspaper in his own special shorthand code in case the plane was shot down. It was an unnecessary precaution. He landed safely and rushed to confer with Army Group Don about chances for a dramatic upsurge in supplies. Inside the shrinking Kessel, on the road between Karpovka and Pitomnik, trucks moved carefully through congested traffic. In one of them, Sergeant Ernst Wolfhardt rode beside the driver. Recently detached from artillery spotting inside the dread Barakati gun factory, Wolfhardt was glad to be out in the open, where he could raise his head without fearing that a sniper might take it off. Behind him, someone shouted that Russian tanks had broken into the convoy. The driver floored the accelerator, and the truck leaped ahead, straight at several wounded men scrambling frantically to get out of the way. One vehicle after another hit them and rolled their bodies under the wheels. Wolfhardt saw arms and legs flailing madly when his truck smashed into the victims and passed on. Looking back, Wolfhardt noticed that no one slowed down to remove the corpses. On the western side of the pocket, curly-haired Hubert Werkner crouched in his snow hole. His feet were frozen. Flesh came off them in long strips. His right hand had been punctured by shrapnel, but he had not been able to find a doctor. While Werkner stoically endured the pain, a Russian T-34 tank fired a shell directly at him. Two companions took the full force of the explosion. One man's face disintegrated. The other's right arm flew into the air. Werkner's body was a sieve. Hauled from the gory pit by friends, he was taken to Gumrak, where thousands of soldiers lay unattended. Werkner was placed in a converted horse stable, 50 yards long, with perhaps 20 men around him on cots. A medic assured him that his chances for a flight out of the Kessel were good. A short distance away from Werkner's improvised hospital, the Gumrak Message Center kept up a steady stream of life-and-death chatter to Army Group Don, recording the fading pulse beat of 6th Army. Herr General Paulus gave permission to Oberleutnant Georg Reimann, Regiment 549, to marry Miss Lena Hauswald, Neustadt. Please forward. A proxy marriage. Proposal of decoration General Pfeiffer sent. Oberleutnant Boris received German Cross, gold. Dead in action according to present information. Chunke, Hagermann, Holtzmann, Quatflieg, Hulsmann, Rotmann, Hamann. Losses of officers and troops not accountable at present, but very high. Later, 6th Army Radio, January 13, 9:30 a.m. Ammunition is almost exhausted. For the assistance of the completely worn-out troops, no reserves available in terms of men, tanks, anti-tank, and heavy weapons. A German transport plane circled over Pitomnik and asked permission to land. The request was denied, and General Wolfgang Piekart told the pilot to go around again until Russian gunfire lifted enough to allow a safe touchdown. The plane made several turns before the pilot warned the general he was running low on fuel. Reluctantly, Piekart ordered the aircraft back to Novocherkassk, from where he hoped to try another flight into the pocket. His mission to Manstein had failed. No one at Army Group Don ever offered any encouragement. No one in the Luftwaffe gave him hope, because barely 75 aircraft were left in running condition. More than 400 transports had been shot down. Russian fighters ruled the skies. At Pitomnik, ground controllers finally cleared the runways for landings. From the hospital sheds, hundreds of wounded walked or crawled to the edge of the concrete strip. When Junkers and Heinkels roared in under sporadic gunfire, the crippled rushed the open doors and hatches. Doctors and pilots stood them off with drawn pistols, while ticketed casualties went on board. A major approached one pilot and offered him 10,000 Reichmarks for a seat on his plane. Before the pilot could reply, a mob of wild-eyed patients knocked the major aside and pushed into the aircraft. The pilot looked down helplessly. When he lifted off the runway a short time later, he carried a full complement of wounded. The major who offered him the bribe was left behind. On the same day, a special courier left Pitomnik with Paulus's blessing. The general had ordered Captain Vindrik Baer to take the truth about the situation directly to Adolf Hitler. Still unable to believe that the Führer had written off his army, Paulus wanted Baer to emphasize the fact that unless the airlift brought forth a cornucopia of food and ammunition, 6th Army would perish long before any spring offensive. Stunned and somewhat guilty at being chosen, Bear protested loudly, but his friend Smitchen, General Schmidt, convinced him to go and handed him pass number 7 as his key to freedom. Carrying the war diary of the 6th Army under his arm, Teddy Bear took off at 5 p.m. and soared over the darkened plain, lit fitfully by shell bursts and arching tracer bullets. In an hour, the captain was safe in Novocherkassk, and there he rested briefly before the long trip to East Prussia. The plane that took Captain Bear from Pitomnik carried another batch of letters, from husbands to wives, sons to parents. Though a strain of fatalism predominated, a surprisingly large percentage of them swore continued fealty to the Führer and the Fatherland. Captain Gebhardt, APO number 20329, wrote to his wife, January 13, 1943. Our boss will be flown out and he will take this letter with him. So far, I am still doing well in spite of all the difficulties, the grim frost and the pressure exerted by the enemy. The moon is shining outside, and its blue light gives a miraculous touch to the snow crusts on the walls of the stables in the ravine where we have dug into the ground. Work never ceases day and night, but comradeship is exemplary, so everything is bearable. We, too, can quote Wallenstein saying, "The night must come for our stars to shine." And you at home in our beautiful house, you can live in peace. This is our right and due, and this is what makes us proud. Just as the Winkelried long ago, we have caused the enemy to point all of his spears at us. Everything that will come from now on will be written in the book of fate. They will consider the battle without comparison, the Battle of Stalingrad, to have been the highest, and we swear every day that we will bring it to a decent end, come what may come. Captain Alt, APO number 01876, to his wife. January 13, 1943. I indicated to you yesterday what our position is. Today, unfortunately, our situation worsened again. In spite of all of this, we believe sincerely that we will be able to endure until they knock us out of here. Should the end be a different one, then may the Lord give you the power to bear this heroically as a sacrifice for our beloved Führer and our people. Captain Illegible, APO number 35293, to his parents. January 13, 1943, 3:50 p.m. I should like to thank you all for the love and troubles which you have spent on my behalf. You know that I have been a passionate soldier, that I became one because of personal conviction, and on this basis I swore my military oath when I was a recruit. Many difficult weeks are now behind us, but the all-decisive hour is still ahead. Come what may, we shall never capitulate. Loyal to our military oath, we shall perform our duties believing in our beloved Führer, Adolf Hitler, and believing in the final victory of our glorious fatherland. I shall never lament or complain. From the moment I became an officer in August 1939, I did not belong to myself anymore, but to my fatherland. I do not want to become weak at this time. There is no human being who loves to die. However, if it has to be, then I have convinced myself that I want to be defeated in honest combat by superior enemy forces. With the boys I have around me, in the meantime we shall try to send as many of the Bolsheviks as we can to the happy hunting grounds. You should not be sad. You should be proud during the days to come. It is still possible that a miracle will happen and that help will come in time. Our motto is and will be during the most difficult hours, we shall fight to the last grenade. Long live the Führer and our dearly beloved German fatherland. Gefreiter Schwarz, 12833, to his wife. January 13, 1943. Well, the time has come to be very honest and to write a manly letter without trying to make things look better than they are. During past days, I was enlightened and saw very clearly that the end will be one about which nobody has spoken so far. But now I must express myself. There will be a day when you will hear about our battle to the last. Remember that words concerning heroic action are merely words. I hope that this letter will come into your hands because it is perhaps the last letter which I can write. I am sure that you will keep me in your mind, and that you will tell the children everything when the proper time has come. You should not mourn my death. Should you ever feel that fortune wants to give you a hand, do not fail to grasp it. You will have to live on your own, and I am sure that everything will continue. You will have to take up a job and take care of the little ones. I shall carry you over my heart till the last moment. You will be with me till I take my last breath. I know you are a brave woman. You will overcome all this. You have the children as the pledge of our joint life. At some later date, perhaps you will be able to show them where we were happy together. Live well with our dear children. Embrace them with all of your power and love. Take heart from them. They will give you strength, and you will be able to take heart from them. Life will continue in the children. I wish all of you a good future with Germany, and I hope that she will end a winner. The Russian attack continued, and the Marinovka Nose disappeared from the maps in Soviet and German intelligence centers. The Kessel began to shrivel noticeably as German soldiers ran east before the enveloping arms of Russian pincers. 8 divisions, the 3rd, 44th, 60th, 76th, 113th, 297th, 376th, and 384th, already had been effectively destroyed. Only the 29th Motorized Division retained any strength to combat the enemy at the western side of the pocket. General Ernst Leiser was there with his men, urging them from the houses and holes in which they cowered. He had only 4 tanks left, but after dark, he broke cover and ran forward screaming, "Hurrah!" Hundreds of wounded and previously apathetic Germans suddenly jumped out to follow Leiser in an attack against the surprised Russians. The firefight was a confusion of men and shell bursts, dead and more wounded crying in the blood-stained snow. Leiser had thrown the enemy off balance for a moment, and he needed the time to plan another retreat. In the harsh morning light, his victory seemed pyrrhic, but the general was delighted to find that some spirit remained in his exhausted soldiers. He hoped to find that again when he reached the last defensive line, inside the city of Stalingrad. Chapter 28. At 9 p.m. on January 15th at Rostenburg, East Prussia, Captain Windrich Baer faced the Führer of the Third Reich. When he walked into the crowded conference room, Baer was understandably nervous. He was in the presence of many illustrious men, Generals Jodl and Schmundt, Marshal Keitel, General Heusinger, even Martin Bormann stood looking skeptically at him. But when Hitler walked up and smiled warmly, Baer gathered himself to do the job Paulus had entrusted to him. Hitler was charming, solicitous about the long flight and Baer's comfort. When he asked the captain to speak freely, Baer launched into a detailed explanation of Sixth Army's position. The captain was surprisingly blunt as he told of the dissolution of morale, the breakdown of officer leadership under pressure of Russian attacks, of starvation, and of guns blown up for lack of shells. Baer vividly described 200,000 men dying from official neglect. Then Hitler spoke. With Baer listening raptly, the Führer stood over a table and swept his hand back and forth across a map. Though he admitted that mistakes had been made, he hastened to assure Baer that another expedition was going to break the Russian ring and reach Sixth Army within weeks. In the meantime, Hitler continued, the airlift would enable Paulus to hold on. An aide broke in to assure Baer that sufficient flights were planned. Exasperated at mention of the airlift, Baer interrupted, "But the airlift has not worked." Hitler seemed puzzled, saying that Luftwaffe reports showed enough sorties on good flying days to keep Sixth Army at a level above starvation. As Baer shook his head, he noticed Marshal Keitel furiously wagging a finger at him, like an irate schoolmaster scolding a student for talking back to an elder. Refusing to be intimidated, the captain went on, saying that while many times aircraft took off for the pocket, many of them failed to reach their destination because of enemy fire or bad weather. And lately, the captain added, planes that dropped food bombs by parachute aimed most of them into Russian lines. Emboldened, Baer made one final attempt to save his friends, Friedrich von Paulus, Smitschin, Eichlepp, the freezing grenadiers in the foxholes at Stalingrad, and he said, "It is of paramount importance that Sixth Army should know the quantities of supplies that will be flown into the fortress. It is too late for long-term planning. Sixth Army is at the end of its resources and demands a clear decision as to whether or not it may count on assistance and support within the next 48 hours. Shocked at his own impertinence, Baer waited for swift retribution. Adolf Hitler stared at him. Generals and aides were stunned into silence. Keitel's face was cherry red, almost apoplectic. Suddenly, the Führer sighed deeply and shrugged. Smiling warmly at Baer, he told him he would discuss the matter immediately with his advisors. Convinced that he had done all he could, Baer saluted stiffly and left the room. 1,300 miles to the east, the Russian ring around Pitomnik tightened as T-34 tanks moved within a quarter mile of the runways. Control tower operators waved off further transport landings, and six Messerschmitt 109 fighters roared off the strip to take refuge at the smaller, ill-equipped Gumrak airport, a few miles to the east. On landing there, five of the fighters either overshot the runway or crashed into debris. The sixth plane circled hesitantly, then disappeared to the west, far beyond the Kessel. It landed eventually at Shakhta, and the pilot reported that Pitomnik was no longer under German control. With Pitomnik overrun, Sixth Army had suffered a mortal wound. The end was almost at hand. The transmitter at Gumrak relayed news of its final spasms to Army Group Don. Composure of many troops is highly commendable. Completely exhausted officers and men who have gone for days almost without food have pulled cannon for 20 kilometers through heavily snowed-in and often roadless steppes. Supply situation catastrophic. In some places, troops cannot bring supplies to the front due to lack of fuel. Field Marshal Manstein was not surprised. Threatened by Soviet tank raids himself, he had been forced to retreat another 50 miles west to Taganrog, from where he monitored the pulse beat of his own operations. Along the Upper Don, on nearly a 200-mile-wide line from Pavlovsk northwest to Kostronoy, fresh Russian armies had attacked the few Italian divisions that had not been engaged in December, as well as the entire 2nd Hungarian Army. This latest drive quickly overwhelmed the satellite forces and opened another wide gap in Manstein's left flank. By this time, the Field Marshal's